Hello and welcome to Mentor Dialogue, episode number 536. My name is Mentor Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. For more information or to check out other shows on this network, please go visit their site, evergreenpodcasts.com. So this week's interview is with Justin Hancock. Based in England, Justin has been a relationships and sex educator for over 20 years. In that time, he has worked with thousands of young people in schools, youth clubs, universities, and advice services. Justin created and still works at bishuk.com. That's bishuk.com, which is one of the leading relationships and sex education websites for young people over 14. And this attracts thousands of people per day. Justin provides training courses and RSE resources for teachers. He offers relationships and sex education for an over 18-year-old audience too. He wrote the book, Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To, with Meg John Barker, with whom he records the Meg John and Justin podcast. And he most recently published Can We Talk About Consent? A book about freedom, choices, and agreement, published by Francis Lincoln Children's Books in 2021. In this conversation with Justin, we look at the state of sex and relationships today, typically among the younger generations, the decline in reported sex, toxic masculinity, Me Too, the rise of mental health issues, and how to broach consent, especially in a work environment. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. And if you could just spare a moment, go over and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Justin Hancock, you are a different kind of guest for me. I'm really looking forward to exploring what you're up to and what you write about. Justin, in your own words, how would you like to describe who is Justin Hancock?
I'm a relationships and sexuality educator, working with young people and adults online and in person since 1999. So kind of been doing this for a long time now, I guess.
You certainly have. So tell us, Justin, how you got into this. What was your path into this field?
Through youth work. So I was doing a degree in law for some reason, and but during the summer holidays I was working with young people, and I kind of thought, well, I enjoy this more, and there were many barriers for me being a lawyer as well. So after I graduated, I trained with the Derby City Council Youth Service, and they gave me really excellent training on how to work with young people. And then as part of that training, I specialized in working with young men around masculinities. And that led to me getting a job working with young men around masculinities and sexual health and relationships in 1999. And that's how I got into it. Since then, I've been working for various charities, local authorities. And I've been completely freelance since around 2014. Delivering training courses. But also I run a website for young people called Bish, which is visited by thousands of people a day. It's one of the leading sexuality education resources online. And I also have my own podcast, Culture Sex Relationships. So it's kind of all led to all of that, really. Yeah.
It sounds great. Being trained as a lawyer, how has that informed or changed the way you've dealt with things? I mean, I assume you have some kind of fidelity towards what you did in law and how much that makes you think about the small print and everything.
I did a law degree, so I'm not trained as a lawyer, but I suppose what degrees do and what any education does is to teach you to think and to teach you to learn. I think that's the thing that I took away from it. I think there's some interesting stuff there about intentionality and mens rea in the criminal law and things like that, which I think I've definitely kind of taken with me. And causation is really kind of interesting. I was mainly interested in the criminal law, which sadly is only a very small part of a law degree. Everything else I found really dull, sadly. sorry to anyone who's a legal scholar who's listening who really, really enjoys it. But yeah, it hasn't really been super relevant, apart from when I write and talk about the law and sexuality, which can be very complex and very tricky. And there's a huge difference between the law itself, but also how the law is implemented and how, for example, Crown Prosecution Service guidelines differ to the actual written law about things like Sexual Offences Act 2003. But yeah, apart from that, it's not really equipped me for a career in sexuality education.
Well, I possibly want to get back into that when we talk a little later about contracting after consent. Yeah. But let's say over the last 20 years, it seems to me that we've had a lot of change that has been seen in society, mm-hmm. especially in the West, I suppose, mm-hmm. with regard to sexuality and sex. How would you describe where we are today compared to when you began in 1999?
I think in some ways there's been a huge amount of change, and in other ways there's been very little change. I think certainly the culture around sex. So I think within that time frame, we've experienced what we would call sex positivity, which is a response to what people regard as sex negativity. And I suppose a good shorthand for sex negativity is, for dear listener, if you are thinking about your own sex education, if your sex education was sex is about penis and vagina sex and it's about reproduction, don't get pregnant. Here are some gory images of sexually transmitted infections. It's something only adults do. Don't do it. It's very bad for you. That is a lot of people's experience of their own sex education. And I think a useful shorthand for that is what people just call sex negativity, where sex is only about reproduction, but it's not about pleasure. It's not about, it barely talks about relationships. It's very kind of mechanical, but only biological and mechanical about a particular kind of reproductive act. Consent's never mentioned. Talking about sex is never mentioned. And people are left with the feeling that it's a shameful topic that we shouldn't talk about, and that and so therefore people aren't given the vocabulary or the confidence to be able to talk about it. I think in that time, we've seen sex positivity. So pioneers of this are probably shows like Sex and the City, which I like to hate on for, because it's a flawed show in many ways, but it's one of those key kind of pieces of media that that really kind of set a benchmark for a new way of talking about sex. And I think we've seen that in lots of other ways in society, and I certainly think that there is a feminist element to that, where we're trying to get women to, or try to allow women or invite women to be able to have their own kind of sexual subjectivity. And I think, which is really good and useful. And I think we've had really important conversations about consent more recently. And I think people are wanting to think more critically about relationships and to think differently about how they do relationships. I think that's certainly been the case over the last 20 years. But the things that haven't really changed, I think, are we still have this very strong like heteronormativity, this expectation of the that you'll be heterosexual. I think that is changing, but we still have it. And I think we have a lot of normativities as well about what counts as real sex, and still very, very strong social sexual scripts that people find very tricky to navigate still. And because of our lacking sex education, people still often find very tricky to talk about, and there's a lot of shame and stigma around talking about it. So I think we still have that too. So there's a long way to go. I still certainly have a lot of work to do, along with everyone else working in this field.
I can only imagine. What about from the, you typically tend to work with younger, but I mean, you obviously work with older as well, but the in the younger field, I have two children, 26 and 24. So I've sort of gone through the younger period. They're now sort of full-fledged young adults. Over the years, how have you seen the discussions you've held with 14 to, let's say, 18-year-olds? How has that changed?
Well, one, I was talking about this the other day with somebody, so it's fresh on my mind. So I've worked a lot with young men over the years, and 20 or so years ago, it would be quite common for me to hear from young men, I don't care whether she's enjoying it, as long as I'm enjoying it, that's all that really matters. And now I never hear that. I'm much more like to hear, Justin, how can I make her come? How can I last longer? How can I have better stamina in bed? And how can I be better at it? And I think they're both problematic because they're still both kind of centering the man's experience. So the man is the subject and the woman is the other. But I think it's a different kind of subjectivity that they are wanting to do this thing of giving an orgasm to the woman as if that's something that kind of belongs to the guy. But I think that that is a so it's still problematic, but I think it is a big shift. And I think that speaks to the sex positivity that I was talking about earlier, that there is this kind of a greater acceptance and a greater expectation and pressure for people to experience pleasurable orgasmic sex. And I think that people find it very difficult to navigate both of those things. And I think the approach that I try to take, which is the one that I took with my co-author of my first book, Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To. My co-author was Meg John Barker. I think the kind of the position we tried to take was to be what we called sex critical. So where we try to encourage people to see the messages that they receive in society and these kind of dominant kinds of discourses and to critique them, but also to try to make sense of them. And to use what Michel Foucault would call technologies of the self, where we gather our various sexual knowledges and our various experiences and our listening to our own body and being in tune with that with ourselves and our desires. How can we use that assemblage of things in order to create and recreate our own sexual versions of ourselves? And I think that's the kind of approach that is the most useful because it is about resourcing. It's about giving us a using our kind of own experience and our own sexual knowledges and the things we pick up as resources rather than simply being told what to do by people. And I think that's the approach that I think is the most useful and the one that I think the most valuable and most useful.
Well, it seems like it's pointing towards the idea of self-responsibility.
I think it's we certainly try not to, and I certainly try really hard not to kind of individualize people. But I think that there is a degree to which sex and relationships are and how we feel about ourselves are kind of private things which have been privatized, which is complex. So, we talk about sex as being private, which I think a lot of people still consider it to be. It's kind of can only be talked about in certain forums, and certainly not everyone wants to hear about it. But then that there is also, in addition to that, it's been kind of privatized by the messages we receive in society about sex. So if we're told when we're younger that sex is shameful, shouldn't really talk about it, and any sex education we receive leaves us feeling awkward, uncomfortable, and shocked, then that further privatizes it, which means that it does end up being this kind of individual kind of like tussle, this kind of solo quest to discover our own sexuality. And actually, if we'd have had a better sex education, and the thing that I try to do is that if we have the tools to be able to talk about this with other people, then we would understand that our idea of ourselves can only exist in relation to other selves, and that we aren't these individual atomized units, that we all exist in relation to into everything else, and that we are an assemblage of lots of different things. And I think that that also is the crucial way forward, to kind of to make people look outwards for, or to facilitate people looking outwards for connection and understanding and becoming, rather than inwards for some kind of lack or essential story of themselves.
Interesting. So the way I say I would approach this interview with you, Justin, was to think about also the changes that have happened at a societal level, and to see to what extent there are links. I mean, there are two statistics. I don't have the exact details because it varies from country to country, but very well documented that we are having less sex, at least according to whatever definition that those surveys come with. And second of all, we're having less children in the West. So let's call that a heterosexual typical type of statistic. Yet I have to believe there's a link with the work that you're doing. And I wonder to what extent that those phenomena impacted you, and what are you seeing in your therapy, in the work that you do?
I should just I don't do therapy, just as a disclaimer there, folks. So I can't go around calling myself a therapist, but I'm an educator. But there are a couple of really interesting questions. I think that on the first point about people having less sex, the study my go-to study about this in the UK is the NatSal study, which is a huge academic study, which is done every 10 years. It's extraordinarily rigorous. And there's another one due out now. COVID delayed it. The last one came out in 2011. And it's usually done every 10 years. There have been three iterations of it, and we're all very excited about NatSal 4. Come on, NatSal 4. But with that study, they were finding that people were having less penis and vagina sex, but they were possibly having more different kinds of sex. It did seem like there was some evidence that there was a broader repertoire of sexual activity. So perhaps people are having less sex, but more sex that they want, more intentional sex, more sex for sex's sake, more sex for pleasure. But also perhaps people, by not having sex, are having a better time. You know, there's a lot of sex can be really bad, and particularly if we're just following a sexual script, doing it because we think we owe it to our partners, you know. And so I think that what I was talking about before, the kinds of the increasing understanding of the role of pleasure and how we might have it, and how this kind of thing of being embodied and feeling a bit more sexually empowered, I think could understandably result in less but better sex, or less but more enjoyable sex, or just different kinds of, and also it depends on the study, doesn't it? As you say, you know, some studies might not see having a snog as being sex, but I think they should, because having a snog is deeply sexual and can be incredibly pleasurable.
Well, also we need to clarify for the non-English speakers, because British, because snog is quite a British term.
Yeah, I use very British terms all the time. Yeah, open mouth kissing or French kissing. In French, I think it's called galoche. But we ironically call it French kissing as well. So, yeah.
So the idea of less but better, I also have other things which are in my wheelhouse, which I typically look at, which is the vast increases of anxiety, declared anxiety and depression, specifically among the younger generations. So I can't equate with that an uptick in happiness or in better mental health. And I wonder to what extent the issues around sex have played a role in this increase of anxiety and depression.
Well, I think there are a lot of things that are connected here. I think that if people have anxiety and depression, it often means that they are less likely to be able to enjoy sex. But also, if it's about kind of cart before the horse. So sometimes if people are less able to enjoy sex, that might also have an effect on their mental health too. So I'm not trying to draw any kind of direct lines of causation or anything like that. But I think generally, if we're talking about anxiety and depression, I think we also have to kind of consider the material impacts that have happened. And not to sound like the left wing nerd that I am, but the life is harder for a lot of people, particularly young people, and particularly during COVID. COVID really heightened a lot of pre-existing mental health problems. And so I think that we, looking at, so I was talking about the Derby City Council Youth Service earlier on in our conversation, where I received my training. And, they had youth clubs and projects all over the city, including the specialist youth work team, people like me who would go in and do stuff around sexual health and relationships, but also other kinds of specialist kind of education as well. None of that exists anymore in the same way. And that's true for a lot of places around the country, that the lack of things for young people to do outside of school is really quite stark. And so if there are fewer places for young people to spend time with each other face to face, making connections and socializing, and also being able to access support and resources from each other, but also people like youth workers, then that is going to have a knock-on effect on people's mental health. But also the lack of space generally for young people, I think. So many areas in geographic areas have been kind of privatized, places where young people can just kind of hang out are much more heavily monitored and controlled. And so I think that, plus the pull of mobile phones and the internet and laptops, has shrunk a lot of young people's lives, I think, in ways which certainly I think are part of the assemblage that we need to talk about when we're talking about mental health and young people. I also do think that there is something here about the discourses of anxiety and depression being sometimes unhelpfully talked about in ways where instead of thinking about what might we do to feel better about our mental health and to feel better, and what are the kinds of ways in which we can connect with others that might kind of be really good. I think that when more broadly we're using the terminology of diagnosis, then I think that sometimes it leads people to kind of holding on to the diagnosis rather than thinking about what a diagnosis might do. And so I think that it has a kind of reverse effect where instead of thinking about, well, if I got some treatment around this, or if I was able to access a talking treatment about this, or to be able to get some other kind of resource or support, it might help me do ... instead, I think sometimes people would perhaps talk a little bit too much about the diagnoses or the problems rather than the potential solutions. But also, having said that, there are material factors there too. So the waiting list for child and adolescent mental health services in the UK, known as CAMHS, is huge. It's a massive waiting list. So the ability for young people to find support, it has vastly diminished, as well as the possibilities for young people's mental health to thrive because of the closure of a lot of spaces that young people could hitherto access. So I think all of that is kind of involved. And of course, I guess it's harder for people to connect if the only space where they can connect with other young people is in school, college, university. Well, I mean, less so with university, but school or college. Then it only gives you quite a small window in your day where there is the possibility for making friendships, experiencing chemistry with people, flirting with people, or the everyday business of what I call at my website, my quoting from the Professor Barbara Friedrichsen, psychologist working in the US, micro moments of positivity resonance. So micro moments of positivity resonance are those things that happen on a daily basis where we have a glimpse of a bit of eye contact with someone, or a little something makes us smile, or kind of have a little buzzy feeling from like an interaction with someone at a shop, or going someone with a dog and, you know, stroke their dog and say hello to the owner, or, you know, those kinds of everyday kinds of things. If we reduce the possibilities for micro moments of positivity resonance, which other people call falling in love, but I like to call micro moments of positivity resonance, then we are reducing the possibilities for people to become and to emerge. And, but also, sorry, I'm ranting. The other thing about school is, and college, is that young people are under so much pressure to get grades, to become this ideal neoliberal subject who is, you know, very successful at school and can get a job in a marketplace and to, you know, to do a university course, which is going to be really good for their career. There is so much pressure on young people to not fail. And I think that a lot of playfulness and a lot of the potential for soft skills and a lot of the potential for connection has been stripped out of young people's lives in ways which no one asked for, and in ways which we don't fully understand how detrimental they've been. And I think in that way, it all kind of connects to sex and relationships, or sexuality and relationships, because not so much the act of having sex, but just the possibilities of seeing people and flirting and having these kind of micro moments with people being this joyous activity we do with other people, this, you know, collective joy, a joyous affect, to use like an academic term. And so I think that's the kind of broader picture. And that's how I see all of these things kind of interacting with each other. Yeah.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We out.
Well, lots of things in there, Justin. I was piqued by this notion that the opportunities for young to meet is reduced, and nobody has asked for it. I'm not sure. I feel like there's this principle of precaution that is imposed by the ask of parents. I don't want my child to be out in the street because it's dangerous out there.
Yeah.
And you better put on a mask because it's dangerous out there. And better not hang with them because they're dangerous. And so I feel like it isn't by mistake, if you will, this idea. The privatization is perhaps a new argument that I hadn't thought about. But I definitely see society unwilling to let go, you know, of, because I only have one child.
Right.
You know, and now everything, that's my prince or my princess, and they need to survive because I don't have nine other offspring to help through. And otherwise my genes will not continue. And there's, so I think there's a lot of intentionality behind this notion of not getting together with others. And the harder piece, I mean, we live in, I mean, amazingly progressive, advanced times. And so it's hard for me to think of all these mental health issues coming up without thinking that there's a causality with our, you know, worry about this, worry about that. Frankly, in the way I see things, there's been a lot of reduction of our ability to speak because it can trigger. So you have to be particularly careful about any word you use. And in that, there's another piece, which is, well, are you flirting with me, or is that's dangerous? Let's have consent about flirting. And if we have to contract all these things and eliminate words, as any lawyer might from any contract, it makes for a difficult dance and creating positive relationships.
Yeah, and I certainly have heard this from young people too, and adults. And I think what we're talking about here is consent. And I've written a book about this.
Yes, which is why we're into it.
And it's excellent hosting there to get me to talk about the book. That's just not, it's really you're a pro, clearly. The issue is the way that consent has been talked about and utilized and the effect that that's had on young people. So nowadays, if I go into a school and say, all right, we're going to do a lesson on consent, everyone just groans and folds their arms and hates me for a minute because they think that what they're going to be told is yes means yes, no means no. You always have to ask first before you do absolutely anything, and that men are potential perpetrators and women are potential victims. And the women and the men and non-binary folk hate consent now. They hate talking about it because of these. I get quite wound up about this because of the infantilizing and stupid and moralizing and legalistic and black and white binary way that it's been taught. The way that consent has been taught has been this top-down approach where it has been policymakers and some educators who think, well, of course, I know what consent is. I've never done anything non-consensual in my life. But it's these others who don't really understand. So I'm going to give them this message. I'm going to tell them what consent is and why they should do it and why it's important. And we're going to save future generations. And actually, all that has done is to make people feel, as you say, anxious, unresourced, feeling unable, and feeling like consent is a barrier they have to get over in order to do something, which creates in and of itself much more harmful outcomes, which are non-consensual. So often what happens is people might pester somebody for a yes, and then once they get that yes, everything else seems to be fair game. And so we have this really problematic kind of discourse about consent, which has produced this binary thing of men have to act, has reproduced it reproduces gender stereotypes in really problematic ways, that there is always one person has to be the asker and the other person who has to be the giver of permission. One person is the gatekeeper. In heterosexual relationships, that is, you know, the man being active and the woman has to be passive. And in same-sex relationships, that the idea that there always has to be a top or a bottom, or someone who is the confident one who is sexually experienced and somebody who isn't, rather than consent being this assemblage of actions, and which can be words, but also our bodies and how our bodies interact with each other, which have the possibility of producing collective joy. So rather than consent being a barrier to get over, I think that we should start seeing consent as the things that we do to really enhance having a great time with someone. And how do we maximize the possibility of experiencing joy for ourselves and with someone else? And all of the things that we do in our everyday lives to do that is what consent is. That is the work of consent. It's ongoing, it's fluid, it's iterative, it's generative, it's co-created, and it's constant. And the act of doing consent in that way can be incredibly joyful. And so I think a really good way of thinking about this is to think about non-sexual examples, because I think that really helps us to figure out what we're talking about here. So one example that I like to talk about a lot is, imagine someone's coming over to your house and they're going to watch TV and you've got all the streaming services, okay? Who holds the remote? How do you figure out what it is you're going to watch? What are the kinds of conversations that we might have to make someone feel comfortable enough in order that they can say, I'm not really in the mood for this, or I've seen this before, or these kinds of things scare me, or there are certain things I can't watch. You know, for me, I can't watch anything with injections in, like lots of TV and films have injections and they never tell you. So that's my kind of thing that I would say to a friend. How do you make a comfortable environment where you can both have this conversation? What kinds of conversations might you have before about it? What kind of conversations might you have about the motivations, like what you want to get out of the evening? Are you there mostly to chat, or are you there mostly to watch something? if we are going to watch something, how seriously are we going to watch it? Are we going to watch it, you know, with subtitles on and really pay attention to everything? Or are we going to have something on in the background where we can kind of take the piss out of something and watch it a bit like they do on Gogglebox? Again, it's a UK TV show, which is excellent. Everyone should watch it. It's really, really good. And how do we, if we've agreed on a show that we're going to watch with somebody, you know, just talking about you, dear listener, when you have a friend over or you're watching something with anyone, how do you kind of figure out whether you and the other person is enjoying it? So are they laughing at the funny bits? Are they hiding behind the sofa at the scary bits? Are they just kind of yawning? Are they checking their phone during it? Are they just kind of looking disinterested or talking about something which clearly isn't the TV? And what kind of things might we do in order to check in as we go? So, you know, when we press pause, when someone goes to the loo or gets a drink or some popcorn or whatever, we could say, oh, how are you feeling about this? Is this still okay? You know, should we carry on for another episode and see how it goes? Or should we try something else? You know, these are the kinds of things that we do. None of that is radical. It's the things that we're all doing in all aspects of our lives, this kind of thing. But all of that is, it's this perseverance of sometimes slightly awkward conversations, but we're persevering in order that we can both experience joy. And we do that in all aspects of our life. And the thing that we don't teach young people, well, I teach young people this, and other good sex educators teach young people this, we think that somehow when it comes to sexual consent, we have to say, yes means yes, no means no, get everyone's agreement before you do something, and then you can just kind of do it. And no other aspects of our lives do we do this, apart from things like contractual things. So saying, clicking the yes, I accept all your cookies on a website, or clicking yes, I understand the terms and conditions of this thing, which no one ever reads the terms and conditions.
Boring.
Yeah, quite. You know, ticking a box. You know, that kind of consent is the way that sexual consent has been talked about. And so it's no wonder that because young people have been taught about consent in that very narrow legalistic terms and conditions, tick a box, contract kind of way, that they're all pissed off about it and don't feel like it can help them. And really what consent does is facilitates a really great time. And if we all talked about consent in that way, then I think we'd actually just have a better time in our life. There'd be more joy. There'd be more possibilities for collective joy. I just genuinely believe that. Yeah.
I want to get into that. There's so many other things that my mind is percolating on. You mentioned the self technology of Michel Foucault. I can't help but think, since we haven't addressed it, there are other technologies that have impacted heavily this notion of consent and what is sex in the form of online porn, yeah, and dating apps. Mm. And I suspect that in the latter, the legal elements within it somehow have constrained the freedoms. I mean, at some level, it appears to open the freedoms, but there's a whole lexicon and there's a whole how-to, and to use your word, there's how you should present yourself, it feels, in these dating apps. And then I've been hearing, my daughter studied psychology up at St. Andrews, and we have lots of conversations about how it is on campuses in the United States, for example, where this notion of contracting is almost important for the purposes of safeguarding any act before, as my son had experienced, two friends being expelled just because the woman in particular said that this person aggressed me because I had took advantage of me because I had a beer. And there was no other witness or anything else. And it was just under the premise that one person says the other person was horrible. And then there's no court system. It's just you're out. So somehow this contract, and I don't want to talk about it as a lawyer, but this is where it comes in. We've come to a position where, in order for masculine toxicity to be eliminated from the equation, Me Too not to happen, there's a need for men to safeguard themselves by saying, or at least in the men, you know, heterosexual, so to speak, elements, that they have to safeguard themselves by saying, are you sure you really want to do this? Because if you, I don't want to have a post opposed sexual intercourse. I'm back in the, I'm having problems.
Okay, so the way I cover this when young people ask me about this, and it's usually young men who ask me about this, you know, what if, this idea how do they kind of almost prove that everything was consensual?
Right.
I can understand why that is. I can understand why young men are feel anxious about this. But the way I respond to this is to, I repeat to them what the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK guidelines say. And so under a police interview, if it ever got as far as a police interview, what the prosecution would want to see is, would want to ask the accused is, well, what steps did you take to make sure that it was consensual? What were you doing to make sure it was consensual? And that could be any of the things that I was just talking about the someone coming around to watch Netflix. So, you know, did you check in during it? During any kind of sexual activity, were you like, you know, how did you, were you kind of, you know, they could ask like, were you mirroring each other, or what were the kinds of activities you were doing? Were you kind of slowing down at various points in order to allow their body to move towards yours? Were you noticing any elements of passivity and just kind of stepping back and saying, well, perhaps they're not really ready for that? If they had been drinking, you know, are you checking in about how far they kind of want to go? And but all of these things aren't necessarily verbal, that we use our bodies to do this too, and that we're picking up on everything that is happening in that moment, the vibe, the atmosphere, the, you know, what had been said before, what had been leading up to this, what happened afterwards, the nature of the relationship. And but also it's very uncommon for these allegations to be false. Like, sometimes these allegations aren't proven, but it's very uncommon for these allegations to be false. And, you know, convictions for rape and prosecutions for rape in the UK are incredibly low for lots and lots of different reasons. And I think the criminal justice system is, and criminal justice models, the kind of legalistic models around consent, don't serve survivors and victims very well at all. And I think we've learned very little about justice during our kind of, I don't want to say post Me Too, because we're still in Me Too. So in the Me Too era, I think we've learned very little about consent and justice and accountability and gendered violence. And I certainly think that these kind of narrow legalistic models that I've been talking about have not only not helped, but made it worse. And I think that this is where we need to pay attention to this thing that I've been talking about, which is the consent as it actually exists, rather than the consent we talk about. And that is about talking about the things that we do to make sure everyone's having a good time. And these are kind of micro communications that we can all just start paying attention to in all aspects of our lives. And then when we pay attention to them in all aspects of our lives, we can help them to come to life when during sexual or intimate encounters too. Certainly, yeah, as I've been saying, I think that when it comes to sex, we sometimes teach, you know, we teach this kind of very different model of consent, which I think is just really not helping people at all.
So Justin, we were talking about consent, and I was having a fun, interesting chat with my daughter, who's studied psychology at St. Andrews, about the notion of stop, which you address in your book about consent, typically aiming for the younger generations. But she brought to my attention a term which is new to me, which is a safe word that is in replacement of stop. So instead of saying stop doing that when you're moving into a territory you don't want to do, you use another word. And she talked about the word avocado or something like that allows for both to understand that this is, you know, in this context, stop. Tell us about how or what you think of that.
Yeah. So the idea of safe words really just came from this very specific kink, which is called consensual non-consent, where people might role play something which might be a fantasy of a non-consensual sexual activity. And so the word stop there wouldn't necessarily mean stop. They'd have to use a different word. So they would have to use the word avocado if they actually meant, okay, I do actually need to stop now. Because the word stop in a consensual, non-consensual scene is part of the scene, if that makes sense. So a safe word there, like avocado, is incredibly important because you do need to be able to say, oh, now the scene actually has to stop. And so avocado, banana, pineapple, people often use fruits. Avocado, the fattiest of the fruit, arguably a really great fruit. I'm not a fan. So
I didn't say mushrooms, at least.
Yeah, I'm allergic to those.
Yeah.
So I think that's where safe words comes from. And safe words has also become this thing, as your daughter was saying, outside of that scene. But the research kind of does show that people don't use, when people want things to stop, or when people say, no, I don't want to do something, people often don't use those words. In fact, people might not use any words, but people do kind of pick up on that. The other person does also pick up on, or is able to pick up on, the fact that somebody wants something to stop, or doesn't want something to happen, through either other words, other gestures, other signs. And so I think that there is I can understand why it is that people might want to bring the word avocado into their intimate lives. But there's a danger where avocado just becomes another word, which is sometimes as difficult to say as stop or no. Because when that word has those kinds of meanings within that specific context where you've discussed it, it can still be quite difficult to say. And so if we create this one word, where there's a lot at stake if we say it, if we change that word, the stakes are still high, if that makes sense. So it doesn't take away any of the thing. In my view, it doesn't take away the difficulties of saying the word. It just gives us another word which we might find difficult to say. And so what we need to take into account here are also potential, power imbalances. Who wants to have sex the most? What are the motivations around having sex? The nature of any kind of sex being co-created, and how mutual whatever is happening is going on. Also this thing of how important it is to just be really attentive and to try as hard as possible to be in the moment, in your bodies, paying attention to the other person in their bodies in the moment. And that means paying attention to all of the different things, all of the different ways we communicate: words, noises, breathing, how flinching, relaxation, stiffness or a relaxedness, but also the vibe of, we pick up on the vibe of the room, the atmosphere. Are we feeling any pressure from anywhere else? Both from our past, from what was happening before, or what's happening in the context of the relationship, or what's happening for the context of us generally. Are we feeling relaxed enough? Is there enough time? All of these things are really important factors in trying to maximize consent and maximizing joy in those moments. So I think we need to go beyond words, whether that is yes, no, stop, or avocado.
So I want to end, Justin, talking about this notion of consent in a workplace environment. I think it's an interesting way to explore interesting conversation. And the context I wanted to draw out, which I know is featured in your last book about consent, which is this notion of greetings and the hugs. So I worked at a company back in the 1990s, and the early 2000s, where we had, as a culture, a notion of hugging,
right?
But not just any old hug, a long embrace.
Gosh.
So this is pre-Me Too, right? And this was men to men, women to women, and men to women. And it was, we called it the Redken hug.
Right.
And this hug was literally 5-7 seconds sort of thing.
Wow.
And the idea behind it was, well, this is how we are. We set it up front. This is sort of part of our culture. And if you're not comfortable with it, then that's okay. You're just not good. We're not the hug isn't the thing you're in or out on. But we had a whole set of codes about how we discuss, how we operate, how we behave, the words we use when we were discussing, for example, the hair, because this is what we were talking about in particular.
Yeah.
And bear in mind that this is the hairdressing industry.
Today,
this is completely untenable. You'd get laughed off the street or screamed out.
Yeah.
And then, I've talked to a few of my ex-colleagues about this notion of where the hug is in society post-COVID and all that. But let's just help us out with this idea of let's consent on some cultural activity that is we feel is part of ours. And it could also be, if I'm Korean, about the Korean way or the Russian way where they kiss on the lips, you know, men kiss on lips. Or the French way where you come in and men handshake and the women and men and women and women all give two kisses on the cheeks.
Yeah, or three or four, depending on the different part of France you're in, which is confusing. Then,
or the three and a half, you know, where you don't know, oh, shit, oh, got the lips this time. So talk about how does one go about in a business environment talking or using the consent, let's say, avenue to bring...
Well, thank you again for teeing me up. If you run a business out there, folks, and you want me to come in and do a workshop with you, we'll happily do that. Get in touch. So I've been teaching about consent via teaching about how to have a really great consensual greeting. And I found it so incredibly useful. And so it was pretty much everyone who has done it, because, again, rather than telling them what consent is and why it's important that they should do it, we've been learning through practicing how we might do a more consensual greeting, how we might bring more consent into greetings. And consent is something we can always have more of rather than it being just that exists or doesn't exist. And so I think workplaces could have I think the issue is, it's about what you were talking about there with hugs is literally creating an organizational culture which makes people do things that they might not necessarily want to do. And it almost kind of sets they're written a script for exactly what it is that they should do. And I know a lot of people who really, really hate hugs, who find hugs incredibly difficult. And so I know a lot of people who, if they're working in that workplace, might not have wanted to work there for very long if they had the option, because they would have found those hugs really hard, you know, really, really hard. And so first and foremost, organizations need to think, are we writing our own scripts? Are we telling our own, are we creating should stories that aren't good for the business necessarily and are bad for the employees? And it's just kind of like a lose-lose all round. Are we in some ways restricting people's autonomy and people's capacity for collective joy, as much joy as you can have in a workplace? By having these kinds of cultures, like one culture around this, which I'm hoping this has changed, is, you know, bear in mind also, I've been a freelance sex educator for many years. Even when I was not freelance, we didn't have an office basically. So it's been many, many years since I worked in an office, but I know people who do still. And you know, the after work drinks culture thing is another one that could be looked at. Or, you know, because, you know, it's often, you know, if that's where key decisions are made and where key relationships are made, then who does that exclude? And who does that, who is, you know, which identities are getting privileged in that respect? But in terms of greetings, I think that what we could do is just to, before we have a greeting, before we see someone, just to slow it down a little bit, just like a second or two, and just pay attention to what it is what kind of greeting they might want. If they've got their hands in their pockets and they just want to do a nod, then maybe you could just step back and just don't go in their personal space, but maybe just give them a little nod, and hopefully they might do that to you too. If you're going in with with two hands, so one hand at kind of like 10 o'clock and the other hand at like 4 o'clock, kind of, and you're doing a bit of a lean, looking like you're going for a hug, and the other person is kind of nodding, and they're 10 and 4 o'clock too, and then that means a hug is on the cards. And if you're going to have a hug, can you pay attention to how firm you both want that hug to be during the hug? Can you kind of notice what kind of hug you're having? Are you going to do the back pats, which, you know, men often like to do to kind of somehow like make it a bit more masculine? I know I do that sometimes, probably. Can you notice the any kind of sounds, or, you know, nice to see you, or the kind of, you know, you sometimes express in a nice hug. And then can you notice the moment when you both want to kind of disentangle from the hug and disengage from the hug, and then notice what you might be saying to each other afterwards, or how that felt for both of you? And was there any kind of glimmers of joy between you? Were you experiencing a micro moment of positivity resonance where, you know, you're experiencing, and the micro moment of positivity resonance includes various neurobiological things actually happening in your body. So the vagus tone kicks in and regulates your heartbeat. Oxytocin kicks in to help you tune in to the other person. Your pupils dilate. Your hearing adjusts to the frequencies of the other person. Your neural pathways map onto each other. Lots and lots of things happen in these kinds of moments. Can you just take like a second just to kind of acknowledge that a nice thing has happened? And that's what a greeting is meant to be. A greeting is meant to be this nice little kind of way of introducing yourself to someone, or saying hello to someone, or to have this kind of a tiny moment of connection with someone, which can feel really joyous, whether it's a hug, a salute, a non-contact greeting of some description, a good old-fashioned handshake, or a fist bump. And again, this is, as you say, this is something we were all exploring through COVID. We all had to figure out what the hell we were doing. And some of us are still trying to figure that out, but some of us have just gone straight back into the script of, you know, what you're supposed to do. And so we just think that, you know, if we are going to encourage people to go back into workplaces, which I, you know, I'm like, I'm all for flexible working and people working in offices if they want to. But surely one of the benefits of being in the office is having people around and having this possibility of these just little moments of joy throughout your day from just interacting with other humans face to face. I'm not saying it's necessarily flirtatious or in any way, you know, intimate or sexual, but just, you know, the joy of a, you know, a colleague or a shared joke, or, you know, a kind of a smile across the office. You know, sometimes I fantasize about what it might be like for me to be in an office, because I just work entirely by myself, and I sometimes think it might be quite nice just to, you know, have this like this buzz of energy that from all of these little connected, you know, interactions. And so I think for managers, for anyone in charge of like policy and trying to create a great office culture, I think that's the thing to really pay attention to, is that how can we facilitate these kinds of things, and how can we, rather than enforcing a culture of everyone hugs, can we instead just say, oh, let's just take a minute and let's all just practice and try to tune into the moment and be in the moment, rather than going ahead and doing the scripted thing. Because if we have this strong idea of a script and we're paying more attention to the script than we are the person, then we're not really maximizing the possibility for consent, and we're not maximizing the possibility for joy. And I think that would make a really much nicer office environment.
Well, lots to unpack within that, but time is of the essence, Justin. For me, the way I'm an older guy, and I didn't go into the military, but I've lived in many countries, and I see the greeting as not a moment of joy. I see the greeting typically is a first regard, if you will, who are you? Where are you? Is in that, you know, just like you look at a book in the cover, you see somebody tall, small, big, whatever. You make judgments and generalizations, and my feeling is that, like flirtation, there's so much that's much more subtle, and if we end up having to deconstruct every little micro moment, it can probably take some of the joy out of the moment. Are we flirting here? So when you expose the flirt, it becomes wide open. Does that make it better or worse? If I could just finish the last piece, is that it's maybe the discussion around this topic that is the inciting or the insightful, the illuminating element to allow for this discussion in the boardroom. Hey, what kind of habits do we have? Because I think it's important to make decisions that not everybody's going to like, because trying to please everybody all the time, everywhere, means you become nobody. Mm. So when you want to create a culture, the idea of doing everything and allowing everybody to be everybody all the time is an amorphous, non-delineated culture. It's a non-delineated group. Mm. And therefore, it's easy in, easy out. Whereas when you have codes of behavior, mm. in our company, this is how we do things. It's not a legal thing, but this is our tenet. This is our principle, our values. And we express those values through this way, which means words we use. And you can choose to be more or less inclusive in that. You can choose to be more or less affirmative or military in style. Mm. And for some, that will suit. And for others, it won't be. And then that becomes the gatekeeper, as long as it's well understood within the company.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're kind of agreeing and disagreeing here. I think the one thing that a boardroom could say that would improve the office culture and the office environment probably is, let's all just pay each other really great attention. Let's just be really attentive and kind and respectful, and we do that collectively. And rather than imposing like a code of this is how we're meant to do things. And certainly if you have to negotiate every hug verbally before you do it, that does make it awkward. I do that as part of the activity I was talking about too. But just to slow things down, just a little bit, just pay a bit more attention to bring some of this. Really what we're talking about here is care and the value of care and what we might call soft skills and the ways in which this might, kind of help facilitate this kind of this collective approach where, everyone is just, I like to kind of think about, when, a football team is really singing, it's hard for me because I'm a Derby County fan and they never seem to sing. But, when you see a really good football team and just everything.
You'll never walk alone.
Well, thank you. Every pass is, going exactly where it needs to be. They almost don't need to look up to know a player's coming in from the other side. And the passes are pinging around. Like Spain versus England, sadly, in the final of the Women's World Cup. Yeah. And they're kind of on song. And it is a little bit like, I think that what I'm talking about here is about the how do we get that? How do we be in tune with each other and in tune collectively? And I think we do that through these tiny little micro moments of paying attention, the kind of the what feels instinctive and what can feel like it's kind of magic and instinctive is actually just a series of microprocessors we're not really paying enough attention to. And so I think in that way that can create an assemblage where everything is kind of just on song and everything just feels right, and just by paying attention. And I think that in that way we can get over this idea of again, I've not worked in organizations, so I'm probably overreaching my expertise here, but I think that this idea of it always seems to be that there is this kind of, in these kinds of discussions, it's either, is it horizontal or is it vertical? Is it horizontal in terms of, should there be no hierarchy whatsoever? Should everyone just be, kind of autonomous, but autonomous knows within this kind of horizontal system where everything kind of gets figured out by consensus? Or is it vertical where someone is clearly in charge and everyone knows what they're doing? And I think that there is to go back to a really great football team, clearly there it's a bit of both. There's a manager who's facilitating everyone being really on song with each other and trying to create the vibe and the environment where they'll trust each other and they can pay attention to each other and through these kind of acts of care and camaraderie and knowing each other's strengths and weaknesses and everyone's possibilities and how everyone can bring out the best in each other. And I think in that way, it's both horizontal and vertical and neither in kind of interesting ways, but it can just be done by really paying attention to the process and really paying attention to the how of doing things, and that is both that's both good for individuals, but also good for the collective. And that, you know, that being part of that collective on Song, where everyone has a degree of autonomy and also is doing this for and is part of this greater good, I think that's kind of like a win-win for everyone. Hmm. I think that's what a lot of people, I guess, in organizations try to achieve. You know, that's like the magic kind of element. And I think that the way to achieve it is through this paying attention to culture and the kinds of things that we can get everyone to do to be more attentive and to be in the moment and in tune with each other.
And also to know how to put down boundaries somehow. It feels like we could open a whole nother chapter about talking about spiral dynamics, because what you were talking about feels very much like the interplay between me, we, and everybody.
Mm.
So there's me, the individual, there's we, this collective, and everybody is everybody. And there's a need to define things within that, because if you're trying to be the horizontal, we love everybody, we take anybody, well, good luck with that. And what is we? Well, we is some small group. Is it big enough? Is it small enough? And what is we? And how do you define we? I reference, or I love to talk about Zim Yatin's book, We, in this particular regard. Anyway, Justin, we could surely, and I love the fact that we end on a disagree and an agree piece. Great to have you on the show. How can people track you down, understand, read up about you and hire you maybe, or buy your books?
Yeah, crucially.
The best ways, yeah.
Yeah, I think just go to my website, justinhancock.co.uk.
And of course, there's Bish, and I'll put as many little other links to your books and stuff in the show notes. Thank you very much for coming on the show again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show and would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
A stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is the reason, still I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hopeful you respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die suburb. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man.
I'm ready, far and around.
I'm a convinced man. In the arms of a woman.
Questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.